from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We've got a busy show ahead of us. The topic that we're going to spend the whole program on is near and dear to my heart. And for those of you that are in the local viewing area on Channel 7 or listening locally, my next guest will be here in Weyburn Wednesday, September 30th at 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Travel Lodge. And he'll be talking about the impact of trauma on others and the traumatic impact on self. And the folks at the Southeast Compassionate Response Team and RPCI are putting that on. Now, Dwayne Bowers is a certified clinical hypnotherapist, a licensed professional counselor, and a Reiki master in private practice. His works include working with individuals and groups. He teaches workshops, seminars, courses, and nationally and internationally events. He also ranks among the very few professionals globally who specialize working with and providing support for families of missing children and missing adults. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, it's easy, you know, as you know, I've told you my past job in law enforcement for 30-some years and being the product of a law enforcement family. My mom was a nurse. My dad was a policeman for a long time. I was a policeman for over 30 years. So we get it, so to speak. But when it comes right down to it, though, Dwayne, in the old days, when you went to a traumatic event or you had something bother you or something upset you or you were dealing with other family, you know that, you came home, you took your uniform off, and you didn't bring that stuff home, and that was hard on an individual. I can tell you personal stories. What about that? The emergency service personnel, the ambulance people, fire, police, whoever, who try to not bring it home with them.
Absolutely. And that's actually who this this workshop is meant for, are the first responders. The trauma that's experienced by first responders, the definition of trauma has actually changed in the last couple of years. It used to be that we looked at trauma or PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as being the result of a single traumatic event and that you would react to that single event. Well, about 2 years ago, they redefined trauma and they started talking about continual exposure to adverse details of a traumatic event. And one of the examples that they actually give in our criterion book is law enforcement personnel who are constantly listening to stories of child sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about long-term exposure to adverse details, now trauma takes on a whole new concept, let's say, for first responders. So it's not just, we're not just looking anymore, did you have a single event that caused you some difficulty? We're now looking at your total exposure over the years, and how has that changed you? How has that changed your perspective? Your perspective of the world? That's one of the new criteria, actually. Do you have a negative cognition, a negative perspective of the world? And we start looking at how have you changed since you've been doing this job, rather than how have you changed since that one event. So the way we look at trauma with first responders is different now. And I think finally, because I think the long-term effects are significant. I work with folks who work with ICACS, which is Internet Crimes Against Children, and what they do all day is watch horrible, horrible pictures and videos of child pornography that is mass-produced and sold on the Internet. I mean, after a period of time of watching that day after day after day, that takes a toll, but that's not a single event. So that's a long answer to what was probably a concise question, but we actually are looking much differently at how trauma affects the frontline responder, the first responder now. in terms of longevity rather than a single event.
And I think that trauma can be defined, as you say, many different ways. Right now, we're seeing an attack on law enforcement in the United States, somewhat up here in Canada. We can think of the Merrithorpe incident and others in Edmonton. The politicizing of these sorts of cases in the United States. You look at that, and you look at that law enforcement officer, that EMS personnel, firefighter, whoever is just getting into the job right now, and they're wondering, what the heck are we getting into? And then you look at the old-timer like me who walks away and wonders, geez, maybe I should have stuck around a little bit longer because, you know, the battle is on right now. Even that sort of trauma is hard on that frontline personnel.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that's probably a catalyst that will bring out the long-term trauma. In other words, if you've got someone who's been on the force for a while and now being the target, so to speak, I think that's the catalyst that brings out a lot of the traumatic symptoms, you know, the anger, the negative worldview, those kinds of things. So I think you're right on target there. And yes, I've talked to a lot of young law enforcement personnel who are just getting into the field, and they're sort of, many of them come from families like yours where many were involved in law enforcement, and they're like, hey, this isn't what my dad talked about. No, it's not. It really isn't.
Well, it's different. It's different now. Policing, EMS, you name it. Dwayne Bowers is here. If you'd like to learn more about my guest, click on the link in the show notes. Now, we just, I don't like using the term celebrate, but we just remembered 9/11. You were there at the Pentagon doing counseling. Those traumatic events that hit you hard big time like that, what is that different from that first fatal accident that the young EMS personnel goes to, or the firefighter or police officer? They don't, you know, hopefully we'll never see another 9/11, but it could affect the person the same way.
Let me give you an example, because I think this really plays it out. So I was at the Pentagon, and the people who were responsible, of course, the Pentagon being a military zone, the normal volunteer kind of personnel could not go on. It was a military operation. So Red Cross was allowed in, but only if they didn't talk. They could only hand out water. And, of course, the mental health folks were not happy about that. But it was right, because if they started talking to these young men and women who were literally going in and pulling people out of those planes, they couldn't have done their job. They would have started becoming emotional, and then they couldn't have continued. And what we started to realize was this was a whole cadre of young men and women, military personnel, who had been trained technically to handle these kinds of situations, but had never done it face-to-face. And so they knew all of the rules and all of the procedures, et cetera. And watching their faces as they went in, finding kids, finding, you know, body parts and whatever, They just were not prepared, psychically, I guess is the best word, for what they were doing. They were prepared with skills. They were prepared with training. They weren't prepared psychically. And I think that's one of the things that you can say to just about everyone around 9/11 is the general public wasn't prepared psychically. Law enforcement, fire, we weren't prepared psychically for that large of a phenomenon, that big of an event. And certainly a lot of changes have come down since then to help us be prepared. But I think that was one of the big lessons.
One of the frequent guests on my program, Clint Van Zandt, is a former FBI hostage negotiator, and he spent time negotiating with David Koresh at Waco. And when you talk to Clint, and you talk about that incident at Waco and dealing with the David Koreshes of the world and seeing those children die and that huge, big event, how do you as a counselor approach that emergency service personnel so they can go to the next event? Because if we shut it down each time we had an occurrence like that, we wouldn't have enough people to do the job.
Exactly. And again, this is, I think, something we are learning in the mental health field is the how to work with that first responder, that law enforcement person, or whoever's first on the scene. And it's not so much to say, you know, one of the worst things you can possibly say to someone who's been in a scene like that is, how do you feel?
Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, how in the world do you think I feel?
Exactly.
You know? So what we start to talk about is, so what worked? What didn't work? What the law enforcement personnel wants to look at is, all right, I survived that one, but am I going to survive the next one? That's the real fear. And so let's be real. Let's talk about that. What did you do that helped you to survive that event? And what have you learned that will help you survive the next event? And that's really much more realistic than let's talk about your feelings, you know, how do you feel, that sort of thing. Because quite honestly, the feelings don't start coming up for several days, actually, after the event. So if you're working with them within the first 24 to 72 hours, there's not a whole lot of feeling there. There's a lot of other stuff going on. But the survival instinct is always there. So what do I need to know from this that will keep me alive in the next one is a good place to start with folks that are going to return to traumatic situations like that over and over again.
Dwayne Bowers is here. He's a certified clinical hypnotherapist and licensed professional counselor. And if you're listening locally or watching locally, you will be here in Weyburn September 30th at the Travelodge, and I plan on attending. When you see stories in the media, Mr. Bowers, and there's been plenty in the media, bad cops, good cops, accidents, school shootings, mass shootings, workplace shootings, you name it, it's pretty much all negative. All of a sudden, that gamut goes from first responders to school teachers, caretakers, parents, families. We all know that law enforcement doesn't have a good track record when it comes to staying married. Divorce rates are high, alcoholism, clinical depression, you name it. What about that bigger picture of the others that are involved, the families and other people who may get in that crossfire?
And I'm glad you brought that up because, please understand I'm not media bashing because media is the way we find out what's going on in the world. But unfortunately, media reports on things that sell, that draw sponsors. And so what is it that sells? Well, they're not going to talk about the school teacher that threw her body over five kids unless there is a value to it for them. You know the people, that I'm thinking of Sandy Hook, you know the people that I really would have liked to have worked with that you never heard about was after the shooting, all of the children's bodies were taken over to the volunteer fire department across the street from the school. And the volunteer firemen and women had to show the parents through to help them find their child's body. Awful. They had to do the theme work activity.
God.
Nobody ever talked about those volunteer fire people.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a secondary or a tertiary responsibility in the event, but that had to be tough.
Well,
and you never heard about them.
Yeah, exactly. Know? And this community has a great force of volunteer firemen. Volunteer firemen and women all across North America do that job, and you hear that term volunteer, but they're out there. And we can't forget our military that's come back, and that brings me to my next question, and you'll be discussing it at the conference, I'm sure, is we all hear in the media, and you're right when you talk about the media, that term PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. What is it? What does it mean to the average citizen?
You know, it's one of those terms that people throw around a lot, like they throw around depression or bipolar or something, you know, those other terms that become so popular because you see ads on TV for the medication that's going to solve it, so people don't really know what they're referring to when they make that when they say those words. Post-traumatic stress disorder, and this is an important thing for folks to remember. We think that trauma is an emotional response or a psychological response. Trauma is a physical and a spiritual response as well. And if you don't treat all four areas, you're not helping that client very much. And so we have to look at what is the hormonal reaction in the body when someone is traumatized, when they experience PTSD? And one of the things I am going to talk about at that conference is we're going to look at exactly what happens in the brain and in the body that culminates in what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. What is the hormonal cascade that happens? And what does that cause? How does the person react to that? How does the brain shut down? Because it literally does shut down after being traumatized. And you know, what can we do to help reactivate it and those kinds of things? So when you think of post-traumatic stress disorder, you really do have to think more globally. You have to think not only of the psychic response or the emotional response, but also what's happening in that body and in that brain, not in the mind, but in the brain. And what else is important is their spiritual aspect. And by spiritual, I don't mean religious. I mean how they see themselves in the world, how they see their place in the world, how they see any beliefs that they may have of something larger than themselves. That all may shift and change. And if you're a very devout person and believe very strongly in God and something traumatic happens to you that makes you question that, many of your beliefs start to crumble. And that's a significant part of PTSD as well. So I don't know if I really answered your question, but PTSD is more than just an emotional or psychological response. There's much more to look at as you're working with it.
Dwayne Bowers is here, and we're talking about trauma, impact of trauma on others, and the traumatic impact on self, and the I guess the chemical reaction on the brain. And I use the example, Dwayne, there's not a police officer out there, young, old, or in between, EMS personnel, fire department personnel, that doesn't think about that case, that death. That child that died, that accident, that situation, sometimes many years later, kind of haunts you. Is that the brain playing tricks on you, or is that something that you need to get some treatment for?
Boy, you've asked a wide question. What happens, the reason that you tend to remember certain things is because in some way they relate to you personally. So it may have been the child that I almost got them before they, you know, fell down the pit. Or it's the child that I could not reach before they got burnt in the fire. So that's my relationship to that. Or it's the child that reminds me of my own kid who died. You know, it's something, your brain is somehow making it a personal connection. And so here's a little known fact about your brain. If you repeat something for 4 to 5 days, you actually form a neural network that tells your brain it's okay to think this way. If you do it for 21 days, it becomes a habit. So once I start thinking that way, if I don't change it at the beginning, it's going to become a habitual thought. And so I'm going to get triggered. And every time I'm in a situation that reminds me of that situation, I'm going to trigger that thought. I'm going to trigger that picture. And it's going to come up. And here's the interesting thing about the brain. Your brain doesn't know the difference between what's real in front of you and images that it creates. And so it responds to the image in the same way it did the real situation. I'll prove that to you, too. How many times have you gone to a movie and watched a slasher flick? I don't care. Friday the 13th or something like that. And there's the guy with the knife hiding behind the door. You know he's there. You know, here comes the guy around the door. And yet when he jumps out, what do?
Yeah.
You jump. Now you knew he was there. And here's the other thing. You know this is a movie. This isn't real. And yet your body reacted to it as if it was real. Your brain really processes every image in front of it as if it's real. So when you have one of those trigger memories, your body's going to react the same way it did to the real event. That's where we as clinicians can start working with you, because we can help you to control the body's response and change the meaning you're giving that picture. And that's the real work with trauma. We change the meaning and value that you give the image. And that's where we work with folks to help do that.
You know, I think victim interaction is so important. I can remember doing my first death notification, for example. And in those days, you know, if you the pastor of the local church or whoever would come with you. Today we have wonderful men and women working in victim service is that are connected with all emergency services. But dealing with the victims, again, you have that uniform on, that persona of okay, here's what I do. I'm not the human person. I'm the officer right now. And I've seen victim notifications that are very blunt and direct, and I've also seen victim notifications very compassionate, caring, and understanding. What about that when it comes to emergency service personnel on all aspects dealing with victims?
I'm one of the ones that kind of advocate for the police, particularly the law enforcement personnel, to not be in that role. And the reason for that is, and we see this here in the United States, more and more we have folks that go out with the police to crime scenes like homicides and whatever to serve as the buffer between the law enforcement personnel and the family. I think it's important for the law enforcement personnel to do their job. Yes, they're human, but they can't become emotional, because once they become emotional, they're not quite as effective in their job. So they've got to do their job, yet the family doesn't understand why the law enforcement's not being more feeling, being more compassionate, whatever. I don't think it's possible for a human being to be compassionate and still be able to do the kinds of things that law enforcement has to do on a scene. So it's good to have that interstitial person, that person that can come between to be the liaison or be the buffer between the two, who is more compassionate but can explain what the law enforcement is doing in layman's terms, so that there's a better connection and bridge between the two. And of course, it depends on the jurisdiction and whose responsibility it is to do death notifications. I've done many of them myself. But as a mental health person, I have a whole lot more latitude in how I approach the person and asking permission to touch their hand and asking them if they want water and that sort of thing. That's not necessarily the role of a law enforcement personnel. So I think it's a good idea to have the two people, one who is law enforcement, to answer any questions. You know, these are the facts. And then the other person to kind of tend to the victim who is receiving the news. Am I making myself clear?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, in my era, I was always accused of being too compassionate. But that was just me. You make good sense, and maybe the Jack Webb type of mentality, just the facts, is the right place in some situations. Dwayne Bowers is here, and if you want to learn more about Dwayne, click on the link in the show notes. And one of the things that from looking at your webpage I found fascinating was the term verbal first aid, and I had to scratch my head a little bit about that, and I thought I would ask you, what is verbal first aid?
Verbal first aid is a technique that it kind of grew out of clinical hypnosis, and let me explain that, because a lot of people respond to hypnosis in kind of a negative way. They think of the stage making you duck, you know, quack like a duck. Clinical hypnosis is actually used for things like helping people lose weight, helping people quit smoking, but also helping people who may have blocked the memory to go back and kind of retrieve that memory, a traumatic memory, or to help them with the traumatic pictures that are causing them nightmares or causing them problems during the day, to help them react differently to those pictures. So clinical hypnosis is different than your standard stage hypnosis. So the idea of verbal first aid is that if you're the first on the scene and someone is wounded, how you react to that person actually will have an effect on how that body heals, how quickly it heals, and how much medication it needs. And there's all sorts of research to back this up. And so for a while in the, I think about the early 80s, a lot of our first responders, like our EMTs and our ambulance folk, were being trained in verbal first aid, and that is to be able to say to the person, you know, everything that can be done is being done, and here's what I want you to do. I want you to just relax and let your body heal. Your body wants to heal, but it can't heal if you're stressed. So I want you to relax. I want you to think about your last vacation. Tell me about your last vacation. And there's actually a whole itinerary that you're supposed to follow to help bring them to that point. But that's the idea. And the research has shown that people who actually go into what we call the altered state, who actually can just relax and kind of go somewhere else in their mind that is relaxing, their body needs less anesthetic once they get to the hospital. The healing time is shorter, and their time in the hospital is shorter. So it was a technique that was pretty popular, like I said, back in the 80s. We've sort of lost it, and we've lost it because, you know, training needs to be fast, get them in, get them out.
Yeah.
And when you train medical personnel, what is funded and thought of as being most important is the medicine, not the words. I tend to think that the words are equally important, particularly with those kinds of research results. So that's what verbal first aid is helping the person kind of go to a mindset that allows their body to start healing and not be stressed, because with all the energy that it takes to be stressed, it blocks healing. So that's that term.
I would be remiss without asking a little bit about the missing and families of the missing, because in my program I have interviewed many families of missing persons, some who are still looking for their loved ones or looking for answers. I never liked that term closure, but we always use the term answers. One thing that I've found both in my career in law enforcement and doing this program is it's amazing to see the strength of the families of the missing, how they turn their tragedy around to try and help others. What about that? What about families and missing loved ones?
Absolutely. I do a lot of work with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children here in the United States. I work a lot with families of missing children, even deceased children that were abducted and murdered, children that were exploited, trafficked. And you're absolutely right. It is amazing watching the strength of family members who are in that situation. But I want to caution you, because you're just looking at the ones that are in front of the camera. You're just looking at the ones who come out of their houses,
right,
and are able to do that.
Yeah.
There are many, many people who can't even get out of the bed, can't even get out of their house because they're so the situation is so overwhelming and they don't know what to do that they just can't function.
That's
Those
true.
Are the folks that really need our help, but we can't get to them because we don't know where they are.
That's true.
We can only help the ones that are well enough to get to us, which is unfortunate. But you're right. The strength, the resiliency is amazing. I'm going to give you a term that talks about what they're doing. It's called post-traumatic growth. And post-traumatic growth is engaging in an activity that allows me to give a new meaning to a traumatic event. So if my child is murdered and I give approval for his organs to be donated, I am trying to give a positive meaning to a horrible event. If I start a nonprofit organization to help other parents of missing children, I'm trying to take my negative event and give it a positive meaning so that my child does not go missing in vain, so that my child will be remembered in some way. And this is part of recovery, and the post-traumatic growth allows me to do that. It allows me to change the meaning and make something positive come out of the most horrible thing that's happened in my life, because I can help others with it as well. And it is amazing the strength these parents particularly have when their children go missing. But all loved ones, all family members, when someone goes missing, you can't really grieve them, because tomorrow they may be back.
Right.
You just don't know how to feel. There's no guidance really on how am I supposed to feel when my family member just disappears. And I agree with you. That strength is amazing.
Well, I remember interviewing Mark Lunsford very early on when Jessica first went missing, and he talked about it, and we all know where that case went. Where Jessica was murdered, and Mark talked about as a parent how you prepare yourself for scraped knees and teaching them to ride a bike, but do you ever prepare yourself for your child being abducted and buried alive? What about that? What would the message that you would give to those out there now who you say are behind closed doors who don't know where to go to ask for help and who are beating themselves up in the inside because they can't get that strength to come outside.
Well, and the other thing they're beating themselves up for usually is they don't know where else to lay responsibility because the perpetrator is faceless or the situation is faceless, so they start doing this blaming themselves and the self-guilt, and that can become so pronounced and so intense that it immobilizes you. If you all you think about is, oh my God, I was a horrible parent, I should have done this, I should have done that, you can get so absorbed in that some folks actually stay there for the rest of their lives, and these are the folks that tend to not get the help. And what I want to say to those folks is, number one, we don't want to live in a culture where you do prepare yourself for your child being trafficked, for your child being abducted and tortured. If we lived in a society where we were constantly in fear of that or preparing for that, I don't want to see what that society or that culture would look like. We aren't prepared for that. That is an unusual situation. We can't expect to be prepared for that. And the other thing is, it's okay to blame yourself. But I also want you to look at every other parent in the world who has had a child and who did exactly what you did and their child wasn't abducted, and tell me what's the difference. Why are they any better than you? And they're not. And that's the point. And the other thing to look at is if you have... One of the things that parents tell me all the time is when their child was missing, they sort of abandoned their other child, and they knew they were doing it, but they put all of their effort into finding the missing child, and of course, that's what you would do. But then there's the whole sibling aspect to missing children. What about the sibling? They become sort of the lost victims of this as well. And I actually was part of a study group I talked to adults who were siblings of missing children. Every one of the families that we did this research on, the siblings were either had poor coping skills, they were using drugs, alcohol, smoking, whatever. Something like 60% had interactions with the law, negative interactions with the law. It was very interesting to see that the siblings had been adversely affected as well. So I kind of got off topic, and I'm sorry.
No. That's just fine. Dwayne Bowers is here, and we're talking about trauma and post-traumatic stress. And let's talk about that a little bit. When I interview doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, I always ask about signs and symptoms. Let's go through that.
For trauma, you mean?
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, for trauma, for PTSD... understanding that, in a nutshell, one of the key components is that you release a lot of cortisol into your body. Cortisol is a stress hormone. Cortisol actually causes many of the reactions. One of the things it does is it shuts down your hippocampi. You have two hippocampuses in your brain. They are responsible for short-term memory, learning, concentration. So when you are highly stressed, when you are experiencing trauma, Your short-term memory is shot, and this is why we always tell victims of trauma, take somebody with you to take some notes, because when you walk out of that meeting or out of that doctor's office or out of that interaction with law enforcement, you are not going to remember what happened. Your friend will have it down on paper. Short-term concentration is gone. The ability to just stay fixed on one thing, it's gone. To be able to learn something new is very difficult because basically that part of your brain is just shut down. And the reason it is shut down is so that your amygdala, which is your fear center, can just go crazy. Warning, 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 warning. And when that's going off, your whole body, your whole brain is on what we call fight, flight, freeze response. And so that means your reactions are either going to be, you're going to lash out at everything and become very angry, and you'll notice that. And when we talk about the long-term exposure to trauma, and we talk about, you were talking about law enforcement over a long period of time, and the marriages tend to have difficulty and whatever, one of the first things you hear spouses talk about is their anger. is the law enforcement personnel's anger. I just can't deal with his or her anger anymore. It just, the amygdala is just going like crazy. And fear is the other product of the amygdala. So those are a couple of the things that you'll notice. It also shuts down our immune system. The body decides that if I'm going to deal with trauma, I can't waste energy dealing with cuts and bruises and da-da-da-da-da-da. So it shuts down the immune system. And actually, the theory is that if you're in fight, flight, freeze, and the predator that's attacking you wounds you, it is better to bleed and run rather than to have your immune system working on stopping the bleeding, but you don't have the energy to run. Because once you get away, then the immune system can shut down. The problem with trauma is that never lets up. So your immune system is always compromised. This is why you'll notice people who are traumatized and highly stressed catch every bug that's coming around, are highly vulnerable to pain, because one of the things our immune system gives us is a painkiller. We don't realize it, but our body is in pain a lot more than we know, because our immune system creates painkillers. When you shut down the immune system, you start feeling pain. And where do you feel it most? In your joints, in your neck, in your back. You'll hear people complain all the time who are highly stressed about, oh, my neck, oh, my back. So these are just some of the symptoms physiologically that you see as a result of trauma or traumatic stress. And there are many, many more, but those are the ones that are most obvious.
There are
Does that help?
It helps, yeah, absolutely. And we'll learn a lot more from going to Mr. Bauer's webpage, or if you're local, come to the conference. And he has posted other conferences on his webpage, too. A couple more questions before we finish up the evening, and I really appreciate you coming on. And one of them is about, and I hope some do come, is administrators, the bosses, so to speak, and what they can do and what they can learn from this. The stressed out cop, the depressed ambulance personnel or firefighter, because something has gone on at home or something has gone on at work, and the last thing you want to do is come forward and say, you know, I don't know if I should be here. I'm kind of bugged about something, or my wife and I have been having a disagreement or whatever. And maybe I'm old school, but it seems like unless you come forward and ask for help, they're not there to offer the help, or am I wrong?
I think we're changing. I think you're seeing a shift, and I think it happened with the rise in terrorism, as we saw our soldiers, both Canadian and United States soldiers, coming back with PTSD, with TBI, traumatic brain injury. We started to realize it's not good enough to say suck it up, you know, get over it, that we really do have to reach out and help folks. And I think what you're seeing, I'll go back to ICACS, part of the state police departments here in the United States are Internet Crimes Against Children units, and they have started to realize our folks need support. And so they're actually implementing programs that kind of mandate that their folks go see and talk to a counselor twice a year, a counselor that is provided, but, and I do this, so I'll tell you my situation. So what I do is I'm a contractor, so I'm not employed by the state police, so that means all of my records are confidential. So when these folks come to me, I can't tell their boss anything they tell me, or I could lose my license. So it's highly confidential, they can tell me anything, and it becomes sort of mandatory for them to come twice a year and just talk about what's going on in the job and whatever. What we are finding in research is the more stressed you are, the more impact a traumatic event will have on you. So it doesn't matter if that stress is you've got your mother-in-law living at home and you just can't stand her, or your cat ran out the door when you left and you couldn't get it back. It doesn't matter what the stress is. If you're walking into work highly stressed and then, boom, you have a traumatic incident, you're going to be affected more than someone who walks in just having yoga or you know, some kind of came in totally relaxed. So we really have to create environments where even if we can't really go, and of course with unions and stuff, we have to be careful, but we may not ever be able to go up to a person saying, hey, you look like you're stressed, you need to go home. But we need to make it at least comfortable for them to say, you know what, Captain, I don't need to be here today. And the captain doesn't need to question. Just say, you know what, fine, go home. We'll find somebody to cover your shift, whatever. So I think we're moving in that direction because people are starting to understand you can't just suck this up. It does long-term damage to you and your family if you're not treated. So I think we're moving in the right direction.
Well said. Well said. Final question, and then we'll finish up. And, again, I appreciate your time. We're in an age of social media. The internet, Facebook, all this sort of stuff, the newspapers, the TV, the you name it. We seem to find out things on the internet before they're even broadcast. What about social media and the job that you do?
It can be a blessing. It can be a curse. When you look at parents of missing children, sometimes the best leads they get come through Facebook. They create a Facebook page about their missing child, and somebody happens to come across it and say, oh, yeah, I knew him, and he told me. And so they can get some good leads. But you also get the really negative people who don't know anything about the case and who will post things like, well, if you were a decent mother, your kid wouldn't have run away, or, you know, that kind of thing. So they can be very harmful as well. And I think it's important, and in traumatic situations as well, to understand that you're always going to have somebody out there who is going to try to hurt you more. So if you use social media to help assist you to resolve your trauma, whatever that trauma may be, realize that some people are going to be helpful, some people are going to lash out to hurt you. And if you're not ready for that, then don't do it. Don't use social media. Actually, law enforcement uses social media a lot because they can get a lot of clues from, like, friends' sites and that sort of thing, and especially when you're looking at child porn. Child porn is posted everywhere to sell it, and so you might find something on Facebook and go, oh, my God, what's that, before they get it taken down. I think it's pointless to talk about is it good or bad because social media is here. It's understanding that it can hurt you, it can help you. And if you don't think you can handle the hurt, don't do it. Or have someone else do it for you so you don't see the hurt that people try to inflict on you through social media. I've seen some really nasty stuff on social media. So I don't have a pro or a con. I'm just saying be prepared, and if you can't handle it, don't use it.
You know, one of the most difficult things when I left policing and retired was leaving the men and women that I worked with, both locally in my department, the EMS, firefighters, and seeing they are the future. They are what I was 30 years ago, and wondering if we are helping them doing what we can, like helping them with stress, helping with them with trauma. And, you know, the administrators, when I announced my retirement, the administrators basically said, okay, what day are you going? And that was it. don't prepare you for what it is to walk away. And I think if we can't protect the people in emergency services, we never will be able to. The gentleman's name is Dwayne Bowers. He will be here in Weyburn on Wednesday, September 30th at the Travelodge, discussing the impact of trauma on others and traumatic impact on self. And that's from the Southeast Compassionate Response Team in partnership with RPCI. Listen, Dwayne, I appreciate it. I hope to have you back on the show sometime, and I'm looking forward to discussing things face-to-face with you on the 30th.
Very, very good, and I would love to come back on the show. Thank you for having me.
We'll talk soon. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that's just it. It's all about those men and women, you know, the officers in the United States are under attack. We've seen it here in Canada. You know, EMS, we have to protect them. Good God, they're the ones that save our lives. Firefighters, military. And if you're stressed, if you're suffering from trauma, teachers, people in medical fields, victims, families, you name it. We got to get you the help that you need, and this conference will be a good one. And if you are interested locally, if you're watching on Channel 7 or listening and you do live locally, you can call the Southeast Compassionate Response Team, 861-2787, to get registration information for that conference. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. I thought it was a very interesting show, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio and the Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.